Most bankers aren't ready to help you until after their third cup of coffee. But with Central National Bank's after-hours service, you don't have to wait for the bank lobby to open to get help. You can contact us from 6 to 8:30 in the morning or from 5 to 10 in the evening, and we'll connect you to a real, live, local person who can answer questions and fix problems 7 days a week. Bank different. Bank Central. Central National Bank. Member FDIC.
This is a Rogue Media Network podcast.
Coming up on The Payoff, Angela Pugh is a recovery rock star. Her whole life was alcoholism and drinking, and now her whole life is recovery and giving back. Her podcast is called Addiction Unlimited. You got to check it out, not just because there's an episode with me on there coming up. She is an interventionalist. She owns recovery homes. She has grown up in Kansas City, moved to LA. Now she's back in Kansas City, travels a lot, covers a lot of ground, working in recovery all the time. And her personality is awesome. She is one of the people that when you talk to her, you feel better after you talk to her. And as somebody else who's in recovery, she is a part of my tribe. And it's very easy to connect for me to connect with people like this. And she's inspiring. And I think you're going to find her really interesting. And without further ado, Angela Pugh. I didn't mean to rhyme like that. But first, Kevin Souza. I was asking, are you in Kansas City or in Los Angeles?
I am in Kansas City.
Okay. How's everything going in the with all the recovery stuff? All like your houses and all that stuff? Good?
Listen, my houses are a little bit of a pain in the ass right now.
Yeah. Really? Like, how so?
It's like it all comes in waves. You know what I mean? Like, it'll be like, I have very drama-free, sober living. We have a very good thing going. But it's like it comes in waves as far as maintenance, right? Like, we have a freezer that's being a jerk and the dishwasher, and I went over and fixed as many things as I could and it didn't fix it all the way. So repairman. And then there's mice at my other house. So we're trying to get rid of that. And yeah, it's like, it just comes in waves. Like, there won't be anything for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then one thing will happen and it'll just be another and another and another. So we're just in that little phase right now.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's better than than people stuff.
Oh yeah. No, people stuff is always pretty good at my houses, but I was very strategic in how I structured my sober living. Not only in rules, but in just being really intentional about the population I want to serve and who I don't want to serve. Also, a lot of concern, safety for myself, right? Like, yeah. I'm not going to work with the prison system and things like that. People coming off the street, like, that's not going to be my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
For a million reasons. But yeah, I was just very strategic in how I set it up. So our intake process is its own thing. My rules are part of that. You know, I definitely have some more rules than other sober livings have. And I'm very hands-on, you know, nothing's falling through the cracks.
Yeah. You're giving so much back to recovery, right? You're giving what was so freely given to you, right? You're giving it away. And that's, you know, that's why you and I are talking. There's a mutual respect and a mutual connection. And there's also like a feel in sync, you know what I mean? I'm talking to another addict, another alcoholic.
Yeah.
I want to go through your story. I'm going to ask all the questions, but I want to go back to the very beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Kansas City.
Okay, so you grew up in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Family, what was growing up family life like? I always, because me, my dad, his side of the family, we always say, like, alcohol didn't run in the family, it galloped. And, I mean, it was big time alcoholism. What did you have any of that in your family growing up?
Yeah, huge. On both sides, too. Mom's side, dad's side, full of addiction. I would say not so much alcohol as drugs, right? Like, I think alcohol came with some of the younger generations, me and my cousins, you know, but really, like, My parents and their siblings were more drugs. Not my mom. She's never done anything. She's the least addicted person in the world somehow. But all of her siblings, my father, many of his siblings, like just a ton of addiction. Like I got it from every angle.
So growing up, were you kind of like hip to that? Was your mom ever like, hey, you need to watch out for this? Like this is in you?
No, I don't even know that they understood that, to be honest. You know what I mean? Like, I think that, a lot of the genetic proof didn't come until later. Because that was part of my story. When I got sober, they were just proving a lot of the parts of the brain and the genetics that were a part of addiction, right? So I think a lot of that stuff had been theory prior, but there wasn't any proof saying that, you know, it's a family disease, so to speak. So I don't think that they were aware of that. I knew, yeah, I had parents that were polar opposites. Like my mom was this incredible, nearly perfect being. You know, she was just a phenomenal mom and smart and funny and so caring and had so much integrity. And then my dad was, you know, exactly who I turned out to be. You know, my dad was just, he was a wild man. He was a partier and he liked to do his thing. And he wasn't like his outward behavior with us wasn't crazy. Like our household wasn't crazy. He wasn't abusive or anything like that. What I remember mostly is like he would just be shut in his room. You know, like he would always be in his room with the door closed. And his friends would come over and go in the room and close the door.
No way.
You know,
okay.
So that was it, you know, but there wasn't a lot of drama or chaos. Like I knew there was discord for sure because, you know, he wasn't handling his part of the responsibilities as a husband and a father.
Yeah.
But we left when I was 7. And I think, you know, obviously when I was a little bit older, things started to become more clear what his.
So he's back in there in that room, probably doing drugs, partying with people. And finally, yeah. Your mom is like, hey, I got to get my kids out of here. This guy's awesome. I love him, but this is not a place to raise a family.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, listen, I'm old. So you're talking
you're not
about
that old. You've said that. You said that on your podcast. I've checked you out. You're not that old. You're not.
I'm about to be 52.
That's not old.
I'm getting there.
All right. Yeah. I'm not too far behind you.
Yeah. Well, it was the 70s, right? So there were struggles as a woman, right? Like it wasn't a simple thing for my mother to just up and leave my father. First, he didn't work. She had to work, right? She worked a man's job. She was only like the third female in our area to have the job that she had. She did telephone repair. She climbed telephone poles. She was 95 pounds and 5 feet tall.
Whoa.
Climbing telephone poles to support her family. Like my mom is not effing around when it comes to her kids,
yeah.
You know? So she's handling business. But when it came time really to leave my father, you know, she had a really hard time finding a home to rent for us without her husband's signature.
Wow.
She had problems opening a bank account without her husband's signature. You know, so it wasn't just a simple process. It was something that she was working on very covertly for a long period of time before we finally had the escape plan.
Yeah, that's wild. Because my dad was, you know, the functional alcoholic, whatever that is. And my mom, I know that there were times when she'd had enough. And I mean, she was like, she still is. She's just the best woman ever. My parents were both incredible parents. They loved the shit out of me. We all come with our faults. And I think my mom didn't have, she had too much fear to ever even think about crossing that threshold that your mom did.
Right. So just flip that, right? My mom had too much fear to stay.
Okay.
And I think, you know what I mean? Like there was, I don't know exactly what happened that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, why she finally said enough is enough. We're out of here. I don't know what this situation was. I think that his behavior was getting a little more unpredictable.
Yeah.
Right. And she was, like I said, my mom's not messing around when it comes to her kids. Like there, do not get between this lady and her kids. She is insane, you know? So him being any type of unpredictable with us would have for sure been it. Like she would not stand for that at all.
Okay. So you're 7 years old, you guys move out. What kind of kid were you?
Oh, those were the best years of my life right there. It was, you know, I was pretty reserved. I was definitely an introvert my whole life. You know, when I was drinking, I thought I was an extrovert, but I realized I was just drunk, but I was never really an extrovert, right? I just drank until I appeared to be an extrovert. But I was always a pretty reserved kid. I was a very smart kid. You know, my mom was super intentional with that. Me and my older brother both, you know, we read before we ever went to kindergarten, and she always worked with us on stuff. And it was really important to me to be a smart kid. And, you know, I was always a spelling bee champ, and I just read books endlessly. Like, you never caught me without a book in my hand. So I was quiet kid. Yeah. But you know, I definitely had all the trauma stuff too. Like, it had been installed. You know, yeah. It was there. I was very painfully insecure and already had that sense of not fitting in anywhere. Like, I didn't look like other people. My clothes weren't like other people. And part of that was where we had come from, but, you know, never feeling pretty enough or skinny enough. Like, I even remember having thoughts about weight and my body as young as like fourth or fifth grade, having those concerns. And like, we couldn't afford the same brands of clothes that other people had. So I didn't fit in that way. You know, just all of that stuff was definitely there.
So now we're cooking, right? You're developing. When is the first drink or drug? When does that take place in your life?
Well, I'm going to give you a plot twist too.
Let's go.
So we got my stepfather when I was 10, and then my mom had two more babies, right? So I have little brothers, 10 and 12 years younger than me. So the babies became my whole life, right? My whole teenage life was helping raise babies. And both of my little brothers had health issues. So it wasn't a normal just having babies around the house. Like, it was a very stressful, a lot of illness, a lot of doctor's appointments, a lot of ER visits. Like, it was a lot. It was a heavy situation. And my stepfather worked. He was a fantastic provider for the family. My mom had to leave her job. She started doing things working from home and eventually built her own business. But everything became about the babies. So all of a sudden, I had this period of years that I was very sort of normal and well-adjusted because I had a purpose,
yep.
Right? Everything was about the babies.
Yeah.
So
you're out of self.
I was out of self, yeah. 100%. And I was super well-adjusted, and I had really healthy boyfriends and healthy boundaries, and I was doing really great. And I had drank one time when I was probably 13 or 14, a friend's older brother, it was summertime, all the parents were at work, right? And my buddy's older brother was a bad kid anyway, and he had Seagram 7, so he got all of us little kids, and we're drinking Seagram 7. I don't know how much I had, but it was way too much. I'm face down in the front yard. I'm throwing up. It was a nightmare. And I was like, F that, dude. That is not the life for me.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want any part of it. I was not a person that drank the first time and fell in love with it. That was not my story at all. I wanted no part of it. So from that point forward, you know, my teenage years were just very different. It was all about the boys and taking care of them and making sure they were okay. And I was happy, had a pretty happy existence. And then...
Are you still in Kansas City? Like...
Still in Kansas City.
All right. Any
then
word
I
from
started
dad?
Working in bars. No, my dad was around.
Okay.
I didn't spend a ton of time with him. You know, obviously he wasn't a safe person really to be around. Yeah. And, you know, more than him, I don't know that I didn't feel unsafe with him. I just knew that my safety wasn't a priority. That's probably a better way to say it. Right. Like, he was just wrapped up in his own thing and he would always have his partying friends around and it just wasn't like, I wasn't comfortable. So I didn't really hang with him too much. Like, I would see him at his mom's house, right? My grandmother was always really tight with my grandmother. So like, I would see him here and there over there, but I didn't like him.
Okay.
Like, I was very aware of who and what he was.
Uh-huh.
And that all that trauma, right? Like, listen, especially as a girl, you know, your dad is the first man that teaches you how you should be treated by a man.
Mm-hmm.
And when your dad doesn't really care if you live or die, it doesn't set a great precedent. You know what I mean? Like, when your dad doesn't even care about your well-being, you know, there's a lot of anger and resentment and disappointment and heartbreak. So I had all of those issues with him, you know, long before I could articulate it or put words to it. Yeah. I had all of that with him.
Yeah, that's what that's. Well, I mean, I don't want to jump forward. We'll get to this. But that's why a program in sobriety is just instrumental to living life like to your fullest, because it teaches you how to go through all that stuff. Because, you know, we all have it. And when we get sober, it's like, okay, let's take time to take a look at it, you know. Now, you start to drink, like you mentioned the first time with the Seagrams. Then you mentioned, I cut you off, but you mentioned working in bars. I would imagine that for me, working in bars was like a launching pad. I mean, I had been drinking a little bit, and I love drinking. But once I started to work in that environment, it was over before it started.
100%. And I can look back now where, like, I wasn't drinking like a maniac from day one, right? Like, I had no tolerance. I wasn't like obsessed with alcohol or anything from day one. But you're right. Once you're in that environment, you know, everybody that I saw drank every day.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden that was normal. I thought everybody in the world drank every day, you know? So it became normal. And now looking back, it's like, I wasn't crazy out of control from day one, but I drank every day from day one. And there's nothing normal about that either, right? Like, non-addicted people don't drink every day. They don't think about drinking every day. They don't even consider drinking every day, even if it's only a couple of drinks, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I did it wrong from the beginning. It took me a long time to really get out of control. You know, I had many, many years that I drank pretty mellow. Definitely drank alcoholically, no doubt, but I didn't have any consequences. I wasn't crazy. I wasn't sloppy. I wasn't getting in any trouble. I wasn't doing anything nuts. I was a very controlled drunk person. Just, I'm a very controlled person in general. But so drinking, I was the same way, right? And my tolerance built up so slowly over time that I just was not ever really a sloppy drunk. And until probably the very end, I started to get a little sloppy. But
so were you bartending at this time?
Yeah, I was bartending and just having a blast, you know. I mean, what a great freaking job. Like, I made such ridiculous money from such a young age.
Where did you bartend? Any place you care to mention? Like,
I mean, I don't even think any place that even exists anymore. It's like 100 years ago. You
know? But you were bartending in Kansas City, and I would imagine like
I did some bar back in Kansas City, and then I moved to LA. I moved to LA right before I turned 21.
Uh-huh.
So I saved up whole like $64, and I moved across the country.
So what was the motive to move across the country?
You know, really, I always loved California. I have an aunt and uncle that lived in San Diego, so I would go there for spring breaks and stuff. And I mean, listen, the 80s, hair bands, heavy metal, the whole thing. And we would drive from San Diego up to LA and spend time up there. And I just loved the whole vibe, right? And I knew I wanted out of Kansas City. You know, one of my struggles was just, you hear a lot of alcoholics talk about this, just the never fitting in, right? Just like I talked about when I was a kid, I had that stuff. Well, even as I hesitate to say adult because I'm only 20 years old, but even as a young woman, like, I just didn't fit in. And I was always just a little extra for Kansas City, right? A little more flamboyant, a little more out there. I'm more of a go-getter. And this is a very beautiful, conservative place with the nicest people on the planet, but they're very laid back. They're family-oriented people, and they want to work, and they want to take care of their families, and they want to go on vacations, and they're very happy and content, right? I've never had a content moment in my life. Like, it's let's go, let's do this, what are we doing next? You know, more, like a good alcoholic, it's all more. So I just didn't fit, you know? I felt like I was walking around this place, like I had this flashing neon sign on my head, like, what in this picture doesn't belong, you know? And I just wanted to go somewhere where I could be crazy if I wanted to be crazy. And I didn't have every person in my family judging every move I made and everything I did that wasn't quote unquote right, you know? Like, I knew I didn't want to get married. I knew I didn't want to have kids. I knew I wanted to be rich. I knew I wanted to have businesses. And that just wasn't the norm where I was, you know? So I was like, I got to get out of here and go where the people are going for it. That's what I want.
So you get to LA. Did you feel the immediate sense of, forget alcohol and anything like that, but when you got there and you're, let's say you're on the strip or going to watch music or whatever, you know, those, you mentioned like those 80s rock bands. That was a really cool time. I mean, just the stuff I see and read and watch about it. Cause I love that kind of music, like, you know, just Guns N' Roses and all that stuff, Motley Crue. Like when you got there, were you like, these are my people, I'm here, I'm home? Or were you like, ooh, wherever I go, there I am?
Oh no, I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled. And are you kidding me? All those beautiful boys. Yeah, no, it was perfect. It was absolute perfection. It was so much fun. And being in the bars, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't worry about getting a job or not being able to. It's not like I was an actor where, you know, I didn't have paid work. Like, I knew I would get a job immediately.
Yeah.
Because there's a million bars, right?
And so, you know how to bartend.
And I know how to bartend, yeah. Right. So, yeah, I just got right in the mix, like, having a blast. I will say that, you know, once I was in such a different environment, I definitely, like, my Midwestern roots definitely became more clear to me, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and my more conservative pieces were like, oh, there they are. Okay. Yeah. My mom would be proud to know that's there.
You still have it in at the core.
Yeah, my roots were still my roots.
When you left,
no, I loved it.
When you left Kansas City, did you break any hearts? Did you leave any relationships behind? No?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you get to California.
Gosh, I don't even know that I would be the right person to ask. You probably want to ask one of my best friends.
So you get to California. That's a no. So you get to California and you start to bartend. Do we see any consequences start to pop up or no? You're making good money. Where were you bartending? Like what area? What?
All over Hollywood and Beverly Hills.
Awesome.
Yeah, okay. I lived in Hollywood. I lived in Beverly Hills when I first moved to LA, and then I moved into Hollywood pretty quickly, and I stayed. I mean, I lived in the same apartment in Hollywood for 9 years. So, yeah, I had my station.
What was your first moment where you were starstruck in LA?
Kevin Spacey came in my bar one night and I just loved him. And gosh, he was so cool. And his assistant came in my bar, right? And I didn't know that he was the assistant to Kevin Spacey. I had no idea. So one night, he and his friend, say me and my friend, they're like, oh, we're going to go drink after hours. We got some people coming over. I'm house sitting. Do you guys want to come over? And we're like, yeah, sure. So I get off work. We go up and we're driving up in the canyons, right? And anybody who live in LA, like the higher up you go in the canyon, like we hit a certain point and I looked at my girlfriend and I'm like, you don't live this high up. Yeah. You're just a regular person,
yeah.
You know? And so we're just driving up and up and up. We get to this house and right when we walked in the door, there was a huge round like entry table and it was just stacked with mail, right? And there was a manila envelope right on top that said Kevin Spacey. And I was just like, oh,
whoa.
You know, freaking out because he was one of my favorite people. And so I don't know, maybe a week later, the guy brought Kevin Spacey into the bar. And I literally was like going back and forth, you know, back and forth in front of him. And I'm like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. And I finally stopped and I was like, okay, I was trying really hard to be cool, but there's just no way to be cool. It is such a pleasure to meet you. And he was laughing. He was super cool.
So that like, and that's just a window into like the kind of life you're involved in. I mean, that was like the perfect answer to a question like that. Cause it really does. It's a microcosm of how you were living at that time and what was going on. You continue to bartend. Was there like a moment like, as you started to matriculate, you know, as a bartender, for lack of a better word, where you were like, shit, this is my life now. It's constantly alcohol. It's constantly the same people. You know, you and I have talked on your podcast, Addiction Unlimited, which I'll talk about on the intro. I already talked about, cause I'll tape it after. We talked about you weren't like a drug person, but in that environment, you're around a shitload of drugs.
God, in LA back then, like everybody tried to pay you with cocaine. You know what I mean? Like, how many times a night did somebody like slide a bindle across the bar to pay their tab? And I'm like, dude, number one, I don't get down like that. Number two, my landlord doesn't take cocaine as payment. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to need cash, you know?
You were probably perfect for that environment.
It was crazy. But listen, I didn't do drugs because my father did drugs. So that was my vow because I never wanted to be like him.
Yeah.
Little did I know, I was exactly his carbon copy. I just had a different drug of choice, you know, because I turned out exactly like him. But yeah, I never did drugs because I didn't want to be like my dad. That was my thing with anything like that. But all my friends did drugs. I mean, you can't be in LA and not be around drugs.
Yeah. When was the moment with when you felt like alcohol had you in a headlock?
So I remember, this is another really beautiful thing about LA, right, is you are exposed to the sober world, like whether you want to be or not. Like there's the sober community in bigger cities is just phenomenal, right? So I always knew people or worked with other bartenders or cocktail servers who were sober people. And there was this one guy, his name was Noah. I will never forget him the rest of my life. And he used to come in my bar and he was a sober guy. And he would hang out and he knew like some of the girls that worked there. And he would just hang out and drink water or soda or whatever. I don't remember what he drank, but he talked about going to meetings and being sober. And I was 24, I think. And it was the first time that I had the conscious thought, like, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. Because I just knew, again, I wasn't drinking out of control. I wasn't consuming a ton of alcohol and throwing up every night or passing out or blacking out. I wasn't doing any of that. But I knew that it had taken a really significant role in my life. And when I would hear him talk about his experience, there was just something with Noah that I resonated with. And I remember saying to him, like, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he kind of laughed, right? Because how I drank at that point, I'm sure I didn't look like an alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And certainly for the level I got to, I mean, I went pro, you know, but I remember him kind of laughing and like, no, Angela, like, don't even be thinking about that right now. You know, like you're fine. Don't worry about it. And I was like, okay. But that was the first time that I kind of wondered. And it took me until probably 30. I moved back to Kansas City when I was 30. And that's when it got really ugly is when I relocated.
And so what happens when you went back home? First of all, why'd you leave LA?
Just exhaustion. You know, like I was tired of just it's so high maintenance to be in a big city. You know what I mean? Like everything you do every single day requires more energy, especially as a female, right? It's like you just have to always be so aware of your surroundings. You're always kind of looking over your shoulder. Your car is getting broken into, your stuff's getting stolen. You know what I mean? Like it's just a lot. To go to the store is a whole extravaganza of, you know, like driving around the block 18 times, getting in probably a mild road rage event for a parking spot or, you know, having to fight a homeless person for the parking spot or they're trying to wash your car when you walk away and make you give them money when you come out. And I mean, it's just a lot, you know, and I was worn out. I was just exhausted and I kind of wanted to go somewhere and just chill. I just wanted to be able to relax a little bit.
So you go back to Kansas City. And
yeah, that wasn't my choice. I wanted to go. I wanted to go Santa Barbara or San Diego.
Well, those I was about to say my brother. I told you about him on your podcast. Yeah. He lived in Hermosa, Manhattan Beach, and he literally wouldn't leave those places because of what you're talking about. I mean, if he had to go somewhere else, I would hear about it. You know, because he would bitch, you know, about having
to
drive.
And that's how it is out there too, because also it takes so long to get anywhere, right? So we do become very secluded in our communities, you know, and people in Kansas City used to ask like, oh, do you go to the beach all the time? I'm like, no, it takes like an hour and a half to get there. It's only 10 miles, but it takes an hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half to get there. So no, we don't go to the beach. And now, as an older person, right, when I'm in LA, I'm on the West Side. Like, I'm never in Hollywood. That's a young person's game, you know? I'm in Malibu in the Palisades. Like, it's a much more chill, relaxed vibe. And that's what I love. So, yeah, it does kind of end up a little bit secluded because we just don't leave our little boroughs.
Yeah. So, but you finally, you left your borough and you go back to, you know, your original place.
Yeah.
And things start to get ugly. How do they start to get ugly? Like, what starts to happen?
You know, it was such a freaking culture shock because I spent my first adult decade in Los Angeles, right? Like, that's a very different lifestyle and a different way of living. I made a ton of money. I lived this beautiful life that was virtually limitless, right? Like, I could go wherever I wanted. I could buy whatever I wanted. I went to all the greatest parties. Like, it was just incredible. And then I moved to Kansas City, and all of a sudden, it's like, I'm in a place where I don't fit in again, right? And at that point, now I'm a decade strong. I was very LA, and yeah. You transplant me back to the super conservative Midwest.
It's almost like impossible. Again, like with my brother, by the way, it's worth mentioning, both my brothers lived out there and they worked at the House of Blues.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Bartended there, a lot of drugs, you know, one of them worked security. My one brother was a stage manager there. But when Kevin, especially my brother, he would come back home to Philadelphia, it was like an alien had returned. Like, yes. You know, it was like he was just different. And he loved that. He loved that he was different. And he was proud of it. But he was like you said earlier, like, which one of these things is different? You know, that was it.
So, I mean, you do, like, your whole energy is different.
Yeah.
You know, I had a very LA energy, and you put me back in the Midwest, where people are very mellow and chill, and like their idea of dressing up is their best pair of jeans, and I'm in feather boas everywhere I go. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was different. It was different. And also, you know, there's a piece of that too where it's like, I felt like I couldn't even be myself, because if I were to share, just like, I remember one night talking or listening really to some people talk. And I was like, I can't even share my stories of what I was doing a week ago. And the week prior, we were at a party, right? But we were deep sea fishing with like one of the biggest rock stars from the 80s, right? Uh-huh. Like, that's what I was doing the week before.
Are you going to tell me his name later, or no?
No, not okay. On here. But a week later, I'm sitting and I'm thinking, like, I can't even share my stories because people will just assume I'm lying anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, I felt like I had to downplay and hide so much of just who I was because I was back in that situation where I just didn't fit.
Yeah. And so the drinking totally starts to ramp up.
Crazy.
Yeah. What are some of the things?
But I also, you know, listen, this is a crazy statement too, because I also moved back to Kansas City and was start making way less money, right? Because Kansas City didn't have nightclubs the way LA nightclubs were, right? So all of a sudden I'm working at a sports bar, making one-fifth the money I was used to making. And I had more bills because I lived in the same spot in Hollywood forever. It was rent controlled. I had a garage parking spot. Like, I was spoiled.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I come back, my rent is higher. I'm making less money. I feel like an alien running around this city. Like, it was crazy. It was so freaking uncomfortable.
Yeah. And so the uncomfortability makes you just drink more and more. And how do we bottom out? Like, what take me to that moment where you get the gift of desperation.
So I leave the bar one night out with all my usual friends drinking in the usual places. And I went to leave and go home. I did not make it far. And I crashed my car at 70 miles an hour on the freeway and I hit another car. And that was my moment of like, oh shit, like this isn't an option anymore, you know, because I didn't care. I thought I killed the guy that I hit, right? That's just what was in my head at the moment. Like, how do you hit somebody at 70 miles an hour and everybody's okay, right? Yeah. So, and I can't tell you like how long I thought that or when they came over and told me he was fine. I don't know. He was fine, by the way. I was the only one injured, but, it was just like, it never dawned on me that I could hurt somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't care if I hurt me. I didn't care what happened to me. I hated me. I wanted to die every day just so the pain of living would stop, you know? But it never crossed my mind that I could hurt another person. And then it was like all the what ifs too. It's like, oh my gosh, like what if he had a kid in his backseat? Or what if we were on a side street and he was on the sidewalk and I hit him?
Yeah.
You know, like all of these things, I never wanted to hurt somebody else.
And I'm guessing that wasn't the first time you drank and drove.
No, God, no.
Yeah. Were there any other...
Listen, this is a crazy thing too, because, you know, people will say this like to unqualify themselves from having a drinking problem. Like, oh, I've never had any legal problems. I've never had a DUI. But listen, I drove drunk almost every day of my life for probably close to 14 years before I ever got a DUI. It didn't make me less of an alcoholic, right? It just means I didn't get caught. I think it was much harder to get caught in LA because... their police are actually busy. Like they have real things going on, right?
Yeah.
Not like in Kansas City where like the cops are hanging around waiting for you to not use your turn signal or something, right? Like LA, they're busy. They have real stuff happening. So it's just harder to get caught in general, but not because I didn't deserve it. It didn't happen for so long, but it didn't make me less of an alcoholic because I never had a DUI, you know?
So now you're having this breakthrough as like you need to do something. And you mentioned, you know, and I take it that happened over the period from coming back from LA and being home in Kansas City where you start to hate your life and hate who you are through the alcoholism, right? I mean, it's like that vicious cycle where you really just start to beat the shit out of yourself. And then there's shame attached to the things you do when you're drunk. And now here we are. You know, it's gotten this bad. What do you do? Like, take me through the moments, like, or the days after that crash, where you now are in action. Like, Angela's trying to stop this.
Well, first, my first plan of action was to kill myself. That was my solution, because I had gotten a DUI 8 months prior. And had violated the terms of my probation like a few times, and then I crashed.
Okay.
Right. So I had so from first DUI to sober was only 8 months, but I got into a lot of a mess.
Yeah.
In that very short period of time.
Yeah.
And so now my accident, I knew I'd be charged with another DUI after I'd already failed miserably trying to get finished with all the stuff for the first one. And I knew I was facing a substantial piece of jail time because I was a habitual violator, right? So I was like, this is it. Like, I can't do this. I was so disgusted by myself and like having to think about telling my family, who already thought I was insane anyway, right? Because they're all the typical Midwestern people, like grow up, go to college, get married, have babies, buy houses. You know, they're those people. And then there's me, who's just crazy, right? I'm feral. I'm all over the place doing my thing, right? I'm so not conventional in any way. So then it's like, now I got to tell them I have all these legal problems and DUIs, and they already know I'm nuts. Like, I had zero desire to be a part of any of it. And I had this thought, you know, we put so much energy into our outside picture, right? Presenting a certain way to the world to hide how screwed up we are on the inside. And I had this moment after my accident because I face planted the steering wheel in my car. So my nose was broken and my head was cracked in a couple of places. And I didn't have a broken nose, like where you get black eyes. I had a broken nose, like it broke the bottom bone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So the whole lower half of my face was swollen, right?
Yeah.
And then my head was all lumped up from cracks in my head at the top. And I remember sitting there and thinking, like, this is the first time in my life that I look as ugly on the outside as I feel on the inside. Like, where that internal picture and the external matched for the first time. And I was like, fuck this. I hate this. I hate me. I hate my life. This is disgusting. And so that was my first plan of action, was I was going to kill myself. And I don't really know what happened to that plan. I probably went to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I probably went to bed and that was that. Yeah. But yeah, I laid low and detoxed, obviously, for days. I had my Rottweiler back then, and he and I just chilled on the couch, and I went through withdrawal and all that stuff. It was probably about 6 days, really, that I felt pretty bad, you know, like I had the flu and body aches, and It was bad. I mean, it could have been a lot worse for sure, but, and then I just went to AA. That's all I knew to do. You know, I was like, that's where people go when they don't want to drink anymore. So yeah. That's where I'll go. And I found meetings that were close to my house. I knew I would need to go all the time, and I'm super lazy. So I knew I had to find places that were really close to my house, because otherwise I wouldn't go, especially back then, because I didn't do anything. I drank and I recovered from drinking. Yeah. Like, that was my whole life, you know? So yeah, I just found some meetings. I conned my best girlfriend into going to my first meeting with me. And I was like, just get me in the door. Just get me. I've just got to get in the door.
Were they supportive, like, your friends?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were mine.
It was, I understood that we probably wouldn't spend a lot of time together anymore. You know, like, my immediate friends that I drank with all the time, because I knew they were obviously going to continue drinking. So I knew the dynamic would change a little bit. But for me, I knew I had to be out and proud. You know, I could not keep it to myself or hide it. Like, it had to become my identity as much as drinking was my identity.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I
we're
was like,
a lot
I went
alike
to...
in that regard. I mean, from the moment I got sober, and for me, I think it made it easier for me because I was so, so bad. And everyone, if you knew me and you were close with me, you knew that I had a problem with alcohol and drugs. That was it. Like, so why wouldn't I when I got sober? You know, and then the charge of recovery takes over. That coupled with, well, what the fuck else am I going to tell people? You know, like, so here I am. And like you said, that's who I was from the day. And that made recovery a lot easier. It really did. I mean, it just made it easier for me. Everybody knew that I didn't drink. And shit, like, all that early recovery stuff comes up, or it's weird, it's wacky, whatever. That doesn't last for that long, you know? And then you feel pretty good. So you're going to meetings every day. How did your life start to change?
It was crazy. You know, I recognized pretty quickly all of those, you know, we call in 12 steps, we call it character defects. You know, like, I was a liar. I was so selfish. You know, everything in my life was about me. I was super manipulative because I needed everything to be my way. You know, I needed to go to the places I wanted to go to, and I needed it to be with the people I wanted to go with. And if they invited people that I didn't like, then I would get super manipulative and weeding out the people I didn't want to go. Like, everything had to be exactly my way all the time, you know? And it was just gross. And the first thing I noticed is that a lot of that stuff, when I wasn't in that lifestyle, a lot of that, those character defect things just started to fall by the wayside, right? Like, all of a sudden, I didn't have a bunch of stuff to lie about anymore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, all of a sudden, I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I could actually be an honest person. You know, like, I don't have to be super manipulative and, you know, maneuvering all the chess pieces when nobody else even knows there's a chess match happening, you know? So I just started to see that I could become a good person. And I really never thought I could be a good person. So that sounds weird, but it was almost shocking to me that I could become good. And I think a lot of that too is being such a non-traditional person from a very traditional place.
Yeah.
That it was always portrayed to me like I was bad for being the way that I was. You know, like, different equaled bad. So I always just thought I was bad. I always thought I was defective and something was wrong with me. And that's why I was the way I was. So I think that was the first stuff, right? It's just realizing, like, I could be good, or I could be considered good.
Yeah.
And be a good human. It was fascinating.
Well, that's esteem building, right? Like, for me, because I always thought that I lacked confidence, or I was, like, terribly insecure, which I was as a kid. I mean, we all have that rattling around in there somewhere, but I allowed it to sort of take over. And then by the time I would have developed at all as a human being, I started to get drunk and started to behave, you know, not poorly, to say the least.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of a real shot in the arm when I got sober, and I was like, oh wait, like, when you do the next right thing, you start to feel good about yourself, and that breeds confidence. And, like, that was, like, magical for me. I was like, holy shit, I'm starting to feel good, and I'm not defective, you know? Was there a moment you can point to in your recovery, whether it was early recovery or first couple months, year, whatever, where you were like, wow, this shit is working. Like this is, I could see myself doing this forever because I like it.
Yeah. Well, I would say I've had two major moments, right? So, you know, everybody knew, nobody was surprised that I stopped drinking after I crashed my car, right? Because I crashed my car. Like yeah. Everybody knew, I was like, okay, she's taking a step back. And I waited about 2 weeks. It was exactly 2 weeks from going to my first meeting. Before I told everybody, like, I'm not just not drinking right now, but I'm not drinking ever again.
Yeah.
And I was on a date. This guy had come into my bar. He used to come in my bar all the time.
By the way, I know this from talking to you. You keep bartending, right?
Yes, for years. Yeah. Many years. So this guy used to come in my bar and I had the hugest crush on him for like years, right? And he was from LA. So we had a lot in common and he was beautiful. And right after I quit drinking, he asked me out.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, damn, dude, you've got some timing, you know? But okay, yeah, of course I'm going, right? And so we're sitting at dinner and I had told him, right? Like, I'm not drinking, like I just quit drinking. It's been 2 weeks, right? So I was straight up about the whole thing. We're sitting at dinner and the server comes over and he's ordering a glass of wine. He looks at me, he goes, I feel weird. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't want to offer you anything because you're not drinking, but I feel like I'm leaving you out. And so many things went through my head, right? Like, I want him to like me. I want another date. I've been waiting forever for him to ask me out. Like, I want this to be fun and all this stuff. And then the next thing that went through my head was, like, listen, this is not the dude I'm going to marry, right? And I was like, you don't make permanent decisions based on temporary people. And that was the first moment that I knew I was really locked in.
Yeah.
You know, because prior to that, I was so unhealthy with dating. I would sacrifice anything for a boy to like me. You know what I mean? So
sure.
To be cognizant enough to recognize that like my sobriety was so much more significant than, you know, the 10 minutes that I was going to date this person, that was huge. And I just knew like, yeah, I'm really serious about this.
Yeah.
And then I knew the next moment, I was at 4 months sober, about 4 months in, I knew that I wanted my whole life to revolve around recovery. There was no, I didn't know what that was going to look like. I just knew that I wanted everything I did to be recovery related forever.
And I love how, you know, you were working in a bar. I mean, this is not like a blueprint for people like to get sober and do, but that this is your story. And I love how you talked about being around recovery in LA, and a lot of people are in that industry and they're sober. So like navigating that, like how you did, I would imagine like you were just really in the program. Like you're in the program. Like you said, it became who you were. I think that's essential. For me, it was to get sober.
I think you have to match the energy, right? That's how it made sense to me. It's like, well, I drank every day, so I need to go to a meeting every day. Like that was just logic to me.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't that AA says show up every day. I just knew I had to match the energy. Whatever energy I put into drinking, I needed to put the same energy into sobriety.
Yeah.
Period. But it just was so logical to me. But I did, you know, I went to a meeting every day at noon in the bar where I worked when I got sober. I had to be at work at 5. So I would go sit in my noon meeting and I was on fire. I mean, I was loving this. Yeah. Every person that shared, I was like, hell yes, me too. I did the same thing, or I thought that too. You know, like every person, I felt like all of the confusion of my whole life was starting to come together and make sense. And I wasn't defective, right? I thought I was defective and not repairable until I got to AA. And I started to understand there's nothing wrong with me, right? And I'm fixable. But I was just learning so much about myself and my personality and who I was. And I would get to work at 5 and I'd be like, guess what I learned in AA today?
Yeah.
I'm telling everybody, I'm serving all my regulars their beers and telling them the life lessons I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, but it was incredible. And everybody was so on board. And then all my regulars, and we had another restaurant across the street from my bar that when they would close, they'd all come over to my bar and drink, right? Which is just service industry. It's how we all are. And they started celebrating my months with me, you know? So they're showing up with cupcakes to celebrate my 2 months and 3 months and 4 months. And like everybody was just so on my team. And had I not had that environment, I don't know if I would have been able to bartend and stay sober.
Yeah.
I just had worked at that particular place for a really long time, and it was my extended family, you know? So I was welcome to really be myself and be open, and everybody just jumped right on to support me. If that wasn't the situation, I don't know that I would have stayed.
Tell me something that I know nothing about. What's it like being an attractive woman in the rooms of recovery, like early on? Like, is there anything like scary about that? Is there anything, something like...
This is a really big question you've just presented. I'll tell you, it is different being a girl all the way around, okay, right? Like, something you have to understand being a girl is you have to always be aware of your surroundings. You have to always have some level of awareness of what's happening around you, who's behind you, who's by your car, you know, because it's not safe, unfortunately. And the bad thing as a girl is it's not that we think that all guys are bad. It's that you don't know which ones are bad and which ones aren't.
Sure.
And you're not going to risk your safety to find out, right? Like, oh, well, I hope he's not bad. Yeah, let's go in the dark alley together. You know, like so you have to be very discerning. So I think there is, you already have that awareness as a woman anyway, right? So I think when you walk into those rooms, you know, obviously men are often more sexually driven than women, mm-hmm, right? I'm trying to be so PC.
Well, no, and look, I'll stop you and say 99% of everybody in there is awesome. But there are a couple outliers where you just like, as a guy, you'll see some stuff after a meeting. I'm like, really, dude? Like,
yeah,
she just walked in, you know, like, so it's kind of like, I was just curious. I don't need a whole dissertation.
It's so gross. Now, yeah. Listen, you're also talking about rooms full of people with sex addiction, mm-hmm, love addiction, codependence, people pleasing, right? And all of those things, you put them all together with people that struggle with boundaries and people who struggle with relationships anyway. And yeah, you've got a recipe for disaster. So yeah I would say you've got to be mindful for sure. For women, I mean, listen, it's fantastic that you can go to women's meetings if you're more comfortable in that environment. You don't want to mess with the guys.
Yeah.
You're definitely, people are going to do and say inappropriate things. I think the thing you have to realize is that's not different in AA than it is at the grocery store or the gym.
100%.
Right? Yeah. Like, that stuff is going to happen regardless of what room you're in. Mm-hmm. It's not AA's fault that certain people are pervs. I also want to say, women are just as guilty as men, because see, everybody likes to talk about men being the creeps. But women do similar things just in a little different way.
Yeah.
You know, women have their own ways that there's a term in love addiction called intriguing that is a really fantastic concept. But women have their own ways of doing things and taking actions and being intentional in what they're doing to get attention from different people in different ways. So it's not always men being creepers either. Men are probably just a little more direct about it, and women are a little more undercover about it and then play coy. But everybody is a mess, you know?
Yeah, so totally. Anybody can walk through those rooms.
So all of that mess is going to come out, you know?
Yeah. So I you start to, like you mentioned, you're really now starting, like, the sunlight of the spirit's coming through you. I can tell just by what you're talking about with, like, at work and stuff. When do you make the decision that, okay, now this is not only going to be who I am, this is legitimately going to be my life, my business, my purpose, right? Like, when does that happen, and how do you make it happen?
So business-wise, so I got my first life coach certification when I was about 2 years sober. And that was something I was always interested in.
When did you get sober, by the way? What year?
2006.
Okay.
And I got my first life coach certification in 2008. I was always interested. I was always obsessed with self-help, mm-hmm, right? I mean, I could barely string a sentence together, but I always, I was always obsessed with self-help and personal development and all that stuff. And, you know, I followed Tony Robbins from the time I was a very young teenager. So back then it was cassette tapes, right? I had all his cassette tapes, and then it was DVDs and CDs, but, I just loved the personal empowerment stuff. So for me, recovery played right into that, where it's so weird. I feel like my experience in sobriety is so odd from other people, because so many people get tripped up like on being powerless. They get tripped up on that part of AA and they don't want to say they're powerless and they don't want to call themselves an alcoholic. For me, all of that was super empowering. Like, I felt like understanding I was an alcoholic and having a place to go to fix myself gave me all the power, you know, like, and that's what I'm a power-driven person. Like, that's what I thrive on. So yeah, I loved it. I loved every piece of it. So I go home one night, I think after work, I think it was the middle of the night, right? Cause most of my life, I didn't go to work till 11 PM and I got home. I used to get home from work now at the time I get up and start working,
yeah,
which is insanity. But so I get home from work one night, it's probably 3 a.m, right? And I'm chilling with my dog. And the TV show Intervention comes on. And I'm sitting on my couch and I literally, it was like somebody reached through the television and grabbed me. And I'm like scooching up to the edge of my couch and I'm watching this show and I'm like, oh, damn, like that's what I was made to do. And that was it. I binged Intervention. I watched as many of them as I could. And I just, like, I wanted to be an interventionist. So I was like, how do I do that? Right? Especially almost 20 years ago, like Intervention was not the industry it is today. Like, no, it was a small group of people doing this. And there was only a few girls doing it for sure. So being in middle America too, where there's, I don't have treatment and sober living and all that stuff. You know, I lived in a city that was unadulterated by the treatment industry at that point. So I had to just start digging around on the internet. Like, how do I become an interventionist? What education do I need? What training do I need? Where do I go to get that? And that was really my first thing, was just all my energy went into becoming an interventionist.
And what year was this around?
So that would have been, that was probably around 2008.
Okay.
Probably around 2008. I started cold calling interventionists, literally. Cold calling interventionists going, hey, my name's Angela, and I want to be an interventionist. I'm like, I'm asking people, which is so insane now. Like, I think about how I would respond to a phone call like this today, and most people kind of did hang up on me, but I did find a couple of people that were willing to help. But I was just like, listen, if I pay my own travel, can I come and just shadow you on your next intervention?
For an intervention.
Like, that's it. Like, I just want to shadow you. Just let me sit in the corner. I'll shut up. And I just want to know. I want to know how to do this, and I want to know how to do it really well. And most people did hang up on me, but I did. I found a couple of people let me do it, and I got the education that I needed and the training. I did more trainings, and there was one very small organization, and I became a part of it, and I started going to their conferences and meeting the other interventionists around the world. And that was the first thing that started my career.
How do you walk into an intervention as the interventionalist? Like, is there anything you do to prepare? That's got to be, I would say, you know, AA and God, my higher power, like that, I constantly am using that to walk through fear, right? So I would imagine there is fear, or maybe there isn't. I don't know. For me, there would be, wrapped up in doing an intervention. Like, how do you manage that?
So I'm really in meditation and visualization like an entire morning before I go to an intervention. I do a lot of work with the family, like whoever else is going to be in that room. It's very important that the energy of that room is a certain way. No chaos, no drama, no panic, manic, histrionic, anything. Like, the vibe in that room has to be super chill. And we are staying on point. We're having one conversation. This is not family therapy. You know, we have one goal. And intervention is, it's strategy, right? And every single piece of it is strategy, from where I have people sit in the room, what order we read letters in, like every piece of it is strategy. And you have to be reading all the pieces of the room at the same time to know what your next move is. So there's no, it's predictable in some ways because addiction is very predictable, but people are not super predictable. So you always have to be prepared for, you know, whatever loose cannon is going to be flying out of left field somewhere. And, you know, like whatever, like whoever, somebody's going to throw something crazy out. Like, I remember when you were 15 and you did blah. And it's like, whoa, easy. Okay. We acknowledge that, but we don't, this isn't the time, you know, like it's just, there can definitely be a little bit of chaos, but it is, I am always like my hope and prayer always is that the person feels safe and comfortable and know that we are coming from a place of love. We're not forcing them to do anything. Like, this is very logic based, right? It's like, listen, dude, we just put together a team because we're worried about you. We just want you to join your own team. That's all. Like, we're just having a conversation about what's the best way to approach this.
Yeah.
And I just always want them to feel safe more than anything. Like, they're going to be a little irritated, of course, but I want them to know that they're safe and that they don't need to panic and that we can figure out anything. We can fix anything. And so I'm always just in that meditation, visualization, making sure that I'm doing the right things, making sure that I am conveying the right message so they don't panic. And really, I go into it very laid back, right? Like, the more normal you can walk into that room, it just brings everybody's defenses down. It's like, I'm showing up with like coffee and donuts or bagels. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, because a regular immediately, person.
Just like a regular person, yeah. Right? Because immediately everybody can kind of exhale. And the truth is, we're just having a conversation. You know, when it comes down to it, we're just having a conversation. Like, nobody needs to panic.
Yeah. That's amazing stuff. All right. So what have I not asked you? What have I left out? Because I've kept you for an hour. I try to keep, you know, I try to keep it as an hour. I respect your time. But anything I've left out, it's just been an amazing story. This is one of those stories where I feel better than I did when I started. So I appreciate you.
And you
give me that time. Like, anything else you want people to know about you or about recovery?
I would say recovery in general. You know, we do, because you've got a really amazing story too. But, you know, you get to a place of having an amazing story by staying committed and really just letting your life unfold in front of you. There's nothing I do today that I could have foreseen the day I got sober, or the first year I got sober, the second year I got sober. You know, it's like, you really have to just keep showing up and trust the process. Like, it will, the opportunities will present themselves. Whatever things you want to be different in your life will happen, but you've got to show up in order for the opportunities to show up.
What about you? Where can people find you, like, on social media and stuff? I'll put all the stuff in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm everywhere at Addiction Unlimited. I mean, that's the podcast, that's the Instagram, that's the Facebook group, that's the website.
Okay.
So at Addiction Unlimited, addictionunlimited.com, Addiction Unlimited everywhere.
Oh, well, Angela, I can't thank you. Like, this was an awesome convo. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm so pumped we linked up and got to do this.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
Thanks so much for listening to The Payoff with Pete. Once again, I'm Pete Souza. And of course, we are part of the Rogue Media Network. All kinds of good podcasts you can find at roguemedianetwork.com. And of course, you can find this podcast and all those other ones wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, other spots like that.
This has been a Rogue Media Network production.